will begin by going around and saying hi, starting with Shane and Peter, Linda, Sam, Paul, Tyler, Marv, Bob, Jim, Karen, Franklin, Ken, Jill, Joan, Gaffel, Mick, Katie, John, and Ruth Ann. All right. I probably don't have any announcements you haven't heard before, but just in case, we do have a one-day retreat this Saturday. The schedule is available online, and it's also being sent out in the newsletter. And you're welcome to join us for all or part of the day. And if you want to kind of make a commitment, go ahead and register. But feel free to just drop in as well. If you want to make a whole day of it, it can be quite sweet. There's communal practice, and then there's periods where there's personal practice, and there's suggestions for what you might want to do during those times, including silent work, some kind of simple work, rest, study, that kind of thing. And then we also eat our lunch together, even though we all just go get our lunches and then we do the formal meal together online. And then we are starting to talk about our spring term student program, which the opening retreat is on March 6th. There'll be information about that in this week's newsletter. So be sure, if you aren't already signed up for our weekly email newsletter, I encourage you to do that. Just go to the website and sign up. And there's description on the website and in the newsletter about what the term student program is like. Let's see. I think that's about it. Any questions or other things that people can think of that we should mention? All right. So we're continuing tonight with our study of Norman Fisher's book, The World Could Be Otherwise. And we are on the second part of the meditation chapter. So this is on the paramitas or perfections, and the fifth perfection is jhana or meditation, and then the sixth perfection is wisdom, and we will be talking about that next week and the week after. So we spend 2 weeks on the chapters because they're pretty full of content. And then after that, we'll be going on to a foundational teachings class, and the study material, if you're going to study outside of class, which isn't necessary, but the study material would be from my podcast, and the syllabus, if you will, is on the website now. So if you go to the website and you go to Tuesday study, then you'll see the what we're going to cover in the foundational teachings. All right. So the perfection of meditation. So the other paramitas, of course, generosity, ethical behavior, patience, joyful effort, and meditation and wisdom. And so meditation, the Sanskrit term for this perfection is jhana, which really means the practice of settling the mind. And jhana in Chinese is chan, and in Japanese it's sen. So we are, we're the Dhyana school of Buddhism. So this is our perfection. So I wanted to talk about something that Fisher talks about in his chapter, and I really want to present this, and you know, this may be familiar to some of you, particularly if you've listened to my podcasts, but I also want to make it have an opportunity for you to ask questions. So if there's anything that you want to understand more or discuss, please just go ahead and jump in or raise your hand or something. So there traditionally in Buddhism, I guess you could say, there's two kinds of meditation. So there's many different ways to one of my teachers, Kyogen Carlson, used to say the Dharma's like a tomato and there's many different ways to slice it. So, you know, one way of looking at Buddhist meditation is that there's two kinds, right? There's just one way of looking at it. And that's shamatha and vipassana. And shamatha means calm abiding. Fisher talks about it as calm or concentrating meditation. And this is, you know, we're trying to settle the mind. We're trying to, you know, liberate ourselves from the repetitive and dysfunctional self-absorbed thinking. And we might use various techniques, following the breath, even focusing on a feeling like metta or a word or a sound. On 147, he talks about over many generations, creative practitioners have developed a multitude of techniques for calmness meditation. Some approaches focus on the hindrances to concentration and the application of tailored antidotes to them. So I have a podcast episode on the hindrances. Some suggest focusing on specific objects other than the breath or a phrase such as bodily sensations. Breath practices are quite various, counting the breath in the belly, watching it in the belly, the chest, or the tip of the nose, following it throughout the body. Some meditators practice with a variety of repeated phrases or lists. Some practice repeating a single word or part of a word on the inhale or exhale or both. For example, bud when breathing in and ha when breathing out. Some practice paying attention to posture globally or in specific detail. Some practice focusing on the position of the hands in particular. There is a practice of listening to sound or to silence. And there is a technique of no technique, just sitting and being present to whatever occurs, with what some call choiceless awareness. There are myriad visualization practices and many other kinds of practices. And he talks about then, if if you're just trying things out, or you're at a retreat, or you're following the guidance of a teacher for a while, or maybe you're reading a book or something and it recommends something, to go ahead and try it. But he says, on the other hand, jumping around from technique to technique will reinforce the mind's habit of being jumpy and dissatisfied. So it's best to have a basic practice you do most of the time. So I don't know if I want to just open this up and see if that was probably a pretty exhaustive list of the various things that you might do during meditation. I don't know if anybody else has any others that they've tried that have been successful, that, you know, ways that you focus your meditation. That was a pretty exhaustive list. Shane, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I've dabbled with the Tonglen practice and used the Insight Timer quite a bit for trying out all the different Tonglens that are out there.
Which, would you explain from what that is for people who don't know?
Yeah, I think it's from the Tibetan tradition, and it is basically a practice of You're almost like a chimney sweeper. I can't think of a good metaphor, but you are taking in bad energy and in all of its forms, and cleansing it and then purifying it and sending it back. And you could do that with people or specific people or family members or coworkers or whatever you want to practice with. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah, I did when I go out to Great Vow Monastery, they are much more fond than I actually would prefer of trying different kinds of meditation practices. So kind of every time you go to retreat, it's like a new thing. I just want to sit Shikantaza, but you know, whatever. I mean, I found you can actually secretly sit there sitting Shikantaza and nobody will know for the most part. So, but one interesting one was, so this was a sound meditation, but it was like, it's really weird. They call it the nada sound. I don't know if that means nothing sound or what, but it's if it's very silent and you listen, there's a kind of ringing, buzzing sound. And if you concentrate on that sound, it's, I don't know, it can be like a meditative object in itself. It's like the sound of silence. So that was kind of, and there's something neat about sound meditation, and then it kind of, it's very expansive rather than being kind of an inwardly turned, you know, then we get kind of self-conscious or sleepy or something, you know, kind of outwardly focused. That was interesting. Any others?
I've done versions of, like, I guess probably what's called tantric or tantric. I'm not sure how to say it, but just focusing on like water moving or, not really. I haven't done fire. I know that's a common one, but well, I guess I have camping. but just like similar to focusing on sound, I think it kind of does the same thing. It's a visual sort of, you just get kind of,
yeah,
that becomes your whole sort of universe in a way. It's kind of cool.
So contrast these forms of meditation, which are meant to kind of calm the mind, concentrate the mind, you know, focus the mind, discipline the mind, and get to a point of, I mean, which is like not something that most of us experience very often in meditation, right? But a point of samadhi, which is like one-pointed concentration or just you know, profound stillness and spaciousness. You know, the mind is very, very focused and settled. And I think of that as a, you know, what Kyogen again said, you can't make samadhi happen. You can just create the conditions for samadhi, as if you want a really shy cat to come curl up on your lap, and you're just making the lap. You're just designed to hold very still and make the lap, and maybe samadhi's going to come and curl up on it. But that's, so in shamatha, then we're creating the conditions for that. And then vipassana is the other form, if you will. This is kind of oversimplified, but, and this is really focused on in Theravadan Buddhism, Vajrayana, and what we call the Vipassana tradition, which is kind of a modern term for kind of, I don't know that they shed a lot of the religious aspects of Buddhism, but they really focus on the Vipassana meditation itself. And what this means is insight meditation. So it is we're not just trying to calm the mind, open the mind, we're trying to develop insight, understand something, break through to something, develop something. So you contemplate teachings, you do visualizations. There's very specific meditations you might do in order to gain insight into particular teachings. So they are more, it's more systematic. You know, I knew a guy doing a prolonged, this is one of the things they do in the Theravada and the Vajrayana tradition, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, the very prolonged retreats, like year-long retreats or three-year-long retreats. And in the context of that, if you're doing that and you have a your teacher is, you know, you're working on stuff. It's not like you went on a three-year Zen retreat and you're like, every day you just sit there. You would be, you know, now you're going to visualize, yes, you're going to develop that, you're going to work on this next. So there's a course of study. And I will talk a little bit in a bit about, you know, how do we develop insight in Zen where we're just sitting, right? And we're not as systematic about it, but it happens. So what is it we want insight about? So I think Fisher made a good point that concentration, meditation in and of itself is not necessarily a positive thing. Like what did he say? Like bank robbers could get really concentrated on whatever it is that they needed to do in order to achieve their crime, you know? So it can be used either way. But in Buddhism in particular, we're trying to awaken to reality. And that reality is that all dharmas are marked by impermanence. All dharmas are not self. And if we cling to them, if we resist that, then we will experience dukkha or dissatisfactoriness or suffering. So these are, there's very specific things that we're looking to awaken to. And if Fisher points out that, you know, you might hear this list of things and think it's kind of negative, like, you know, yay, we're going to find out that everything is impermanent and it's not, yourself is empty and all that kind of stuff. He says, isn't this all, page 151, isn't all this sober insight a bit distressing? Impermanence, non-self, and unsatisfactoriness don't seem like the basis of a happy life. In the Bodhisattva path, insight into the three characteristics is more cheerful. Each appears as its opposite. While in the ordinary way of looking at things, opposites are opposites, in the Bodhisattva imagination, opposites are identities. It takes a Bodhisattva to see that it makes perfect sense that if things arise and pass away at the same time, they don't actually exist. If they don't actually exist, they can't cease to exist. Hence, impermanence is permanence. And Bodhisattvas know that if we are not the abiding selves we think we are, we must be some sort of other selves that gloriously come and go in the great flow of impermanence, true selves. Bodhisattvas know that when we slough off our false lives, we get true lives. No longer clinging exclusively to our pathetic, vulnerable non-selves, we become no one and everyone. So in the next chapter on the perfection of wisdom, we'll be going more into this stuff. What is it that we are trying to awaken to? And it's, I think it's really pivotal and essential that in Buddhism we're not, that we don't have to, what do I want to say, work ourselves into some special state to see some special thing, that we're simply striving to wake up to what is. And if we wake up to what is, that will be liberating in the ways that Fisher just described. So, you know, it's not contrived. It's not, Buddha didn't make up some grand philosophy that we need to ascribe to. He just said, look, and here's how you look. And if you look, this is what you're going to see. And it's liberating. So there it is. Yeah, so this isn't concentration for concentration's sake, but because knowing the truth is liberating. So on page 153, Shantideva talks, or Fisher talks about what Shantideva says about this perfection. And he says, it is illogical, stupid, and highly disadvantageous for me to identify solely with myself. Exactly like me, everyone wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. Why not identify with that shared human impulse rather than set myself foolishly aside as if I were somehow different and more important than others? To isolate myself in this way definitely brings pain, whereas to identify with others brings joy. Just as the body is a living unit, not a disparate collection of fingers, toes, hands, eyes, and internal organs, so is all of existence one body. I should identify myself with the whole body, not cut myself off from it, like a severed arm lying uselessly by the side of the road. I should definitely exchange my self-concern for concern for others. So in most, I mean, I'm going to go on to Zazen now, but any questions or comments? Right. So in most forms of Buddhism, you cultivate shamatha and then you do vipassana. So you have to cultivate a certain amount of, like, you know, discipline your mind, calm your mind, achieve some stillness and clarity, and then you apply yourself to insight meditation. And I call this directed effort meditation. I've done a number of podcast episodes on that. There's you have a goal in mind, and you're doing something, and you're working toward that goal. I mean, that's nothing wrong with that. Meditation is a tool. You learn how to use it, and then you learn how to apply it. And to some extent, even Rinzai Zen is like this. The you know, branch of Zen that uses koan work. So they will practice shamatha most of the time, or shikantaza, if you will. And then, you know, when there's a certain amount of stillness, kind of bring the koan to bear, bring the koan into consciousness, and working on it, it won't go into how they work on it, but the point of working on it is insight, is to achieve insight or breakthrough. So in Soto Zen, we have a different approach. So this is what I call letting go meditation. You have directed effort meditation, letting go meditation. So ultimately, I would say the results, I don't know if I'd quite say they're the same, but the results can be samadhi and insight just through a different approach. So we say, what's getting in our way? What is making our delusions persist or our self-concern persist is our own mind and agenda. So learning how to let go of that, then things will open up and we'll perceive what really is. So all methods of meditation have strengths and weaknesses, and shikantaza can be something very, it can be difficult to get your mind around it and what it is exactly you're supposed to be doing. It also is easy to perhaps be too passive in shikantaza. Just to review, shikantaza is that kind of choiceless awareness or that themeless meditation. So we don't have a meditative object. We don't have a phrase or a verse. I mean, you may use that in your own meditation. You know, you may use that for a while to settle the mind or something like that. But But that's not technically shikantaza, right? Shikantaza is when we let go of all of those techniques. And to use my little three S's, which we spiffed up on Sunday, is sit upright, still, and then this is, you know, so the third one now, my husband thinks it'd be best if it's just shh, what's that? So it's not even listen, right? Because I mean, who knows what senses we want to open? So sit upright, still, shh, what's that? So it's just opening up perception, letting go of all of the activities. So at one point in this chapter, Fisher talks about thinking and how, you know, thinking in and of itself is not a problem. But if you look at most of the thinking that kind of gets in the way in your meditation, it's self-concerned thinking. It's thinking about your agendas and you know, so it's basically instead of putting aside our activities for shikantaza, we're engaging in activities. May just be mental activities, but it's activities. So being willing to let go of those activities and just be and perceive, that's what we're aiming for in shikantaza. And you know, I think most people I know, including Fisher, he talks about it in this chapter, they do a little bit of concentration practice and then do shikantaza. You know, they do some of both. And I think that is fine. I think I did a podcast episode about this as well, that like, if you're really curious about shikantaza, just beware of thinking, I'll do it when I'm able to do it well. And if I can't, I'll go back to concentration practice because what I really want is a calm mind. So you're kind of giving yourself like a back, you know, a way out. When like, shikantaza, like, no, just sit there no matter what happens. So anyway, I could say a lot more about that. But in terms of like this whole shamatha and vipassana thing, I would say zazen is like, it's a, I would say a kludge of both, or they're not differentiated. So the way that I could best describe it is, you know, most of the time in our zazen, in the midst of our daily lives, there's a lot of stuff going on. So we may not get very still. You know, we're letting go, but you know, we got to pick everything up again in 20 minutes. So, you know, it's not easy to let go so deeply. But in the context of retreat, you know, we've set things aside even more literally and given ourselves some space. And it is, so I went to a meditation retreat at Great Vow that the teacher was teaching concentration. Like to the point that we put little pieces of paper on the floor and we concentrated on the pieces of paper. I mean, like the whole point of the retreat was to help people develop their concentration. But I don't get to go to session very often. And I, you know, I'm a teacher. So I was like, well, I am just going to sit shikantaza the whole time. I'm not going to do anything else. I'm not going to make any other effort, right? Just to show up and surrender myself to this practice as completely as I could. And I don't know that I'd ever quite done that before in like 20 years of practice. I'd always, you know, struggle with some kind of concentration practice first. And then, like, you know, and then did shikantaza. But I just found that over the course of the week, my mind settled down. I mean, it wasn't without effort in the sense that it's an effort to just show up and sit there. It is. And to try to be wholehearted. But that process of just constantly letting go and returning, I was like, dang, this works. I don't have to work on concentration. This, so it got me to the same place of samadhi. And I would describe it, to use a metaphor, is like you can concentrate, you know, with directed effort, or if you sit there long enough, everything evaporates and then it becomes concentrated. So it's kind of like maybe it's passive, but it's, you know, it's allowing things to let go. And then you do become more concentrated, because after a while, I don't know, you can only think about your bullshit so long, and then, you know, it kind of drifts away. Then in that space of samadhi, one of my favorite lines we recited on Tuesday, in one of our Tuesday chants, not lately, but we'll get back to it now that we have chant books, is bright clarity appears before you. I think it's Hongzhi. That's what it feels like when we're very, very still. And maybe this happens for a moment in our daily meditation. We can even ask a question, you know, what is this? Who am I? What is life? Something like that. And there can be a way that does not disturb the stillness. And then if we look, we see. We just have access to a kind of clarity because of the stillness. So in that sense, and in Soto, the kinds of questions that we ask, it's a little more self-directed and it's a little more based in our lives. So rather than going through a formal curriculum of koans, you know, and then you need to kind of figure out, well, what is this koan getting at and how do I relate to it? So we say that your koans arise in your everyday life. But then it's a process of, okay, you know, what do we mean by that, right? When issues arise in our lives, relationships, fears, I don't know, like whatever issue is arising, that this is a koan, and that underneath it there are always spiritual issues. You know, obviously we have practical challenges in the course of our lives, but it's possible to look underneath and see what spiritual issues are being triggered or displayed in this conflict. And that is our koan. Let's see. So I wanted to say a little bit about Zazen, as he talks about it, Zazen as a practice of imagination. And Fisher talks about these different ways. So he says it's a releasing the mind into imaginative spaciousness. And he talks about little ways that we can encourage ourselves in Zazen to release the mind into this imaginative spaciousness. And he talks about his wife's approach, that anything that happens, any thoughts or whatever that happen in Zazen, she just pictures as snowflakes, and they fall and they just like coat the ground around her. Or she had one where she kind of imagines melting into the earth and being kind of becoming part of the earth, held by it or something like that. And then Fisher says he has repeated the words as he's breathing: slow, deep, soft, quiet. I know one of our Sangha members does just, you know, wholehearted presence. So I wanted to go into breakout groups for a few minutes. And if you have ways that you encourage yourself to release the mind into imaginative spaciousness, to share that. And I don't know if that's a straightforward enough question, if you relate to it or not. I mean, this is a little different than the question earlier, right? What techniques do you use to calm the mind? this is like, all right, maybe you've set aside the techniques, and if you're trying to do this kind of techniqueless technique, and yet how do you encourage yourself to be wholehearted in that? And it can be a practice or a feeling, a word, a phrase, a posture, a thought. At times it's worked for me to say, what if this was the last day of my life? This is my last Zazen period. How would I feel? So that kind of inspiration to be present and let go and engage this as wholeheartedly as possible. So do people understand what I'm asking? And if not, let me know.
Domio, what do you mean by imaginative spaciousness?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of up to our imaginations. But I think I like his use of the term imagination, which is not something that's typically used in Buddhism, because it's like there's a when we're doing the shh, what's that, we're invited to open our minds to what could be, what is, because essentially the truth of reality is so much bigger than our little brains usually frame it as. It's so much bigger. It's so different. It's utterly different. What we need to recognize, what we need to wake up to, we have not even conceived of. We don't know. We have no idea. So that, like, how do you open up to something that you have no idea? So I feel like it's a sweet way to talk about it, is kind of going into the realm of imagination, of being present in your mind, but letting it roam, if you will. Does that help? I mean, to go into this space of Zazen, this space of Shikantaza. All right. Just hopefully, and think about it in terms of, if you don't have anything to share, that's fine. But who knows what you use might actually be helpful to somebody else. So here you go. All right. Anyone want to share anything cool that they heard? I can share that somebody in our room was talking about the using the practice of not self. That kind of whatever happens, whatever arises, the thoughts, the distractions, whatever, and just applying that teaching of not self to it as a way to kind of foster this openness of Shikantaza. I apologize if I didn't summarize that well, but anyone else? Something cool you heard?
I'll go for my group and you can chime in. I really liked what Paul said. It was that he didn't admonish himself when he noticed his mind was kind of going off and he's going, I'm going back. He kind of used it as like, yay, I'm going back, like a celebration, like, yay, this is great, I'm going back. But I liked that idea because I get in that habit of going, ah, there I go again, and get annoyed at myself. And then also, being upright, and I do this as well, Sam, I forgot to tell you, but like using your body, noticing when you're slumping And then using your body to be like, okay, all right, let's sit up kind of, and okay, back here, and just noticing that you're usually your mind is kind of going off if you're slumping, at least mine does too. And then, so just sitting upright and, you know, trying to get back into good sitting posture. And then anyone else want to chime in? Franklin? I remember.
Yeah, I like the idea that reminding yourself that each breath you take is one less breath that you have. It's kind of interesting.
That was it. Thank you. I totally agree on that.
Were you going to say something, Franklin?
No, I'm muted to answer Jill, but I'm good.
I like how it, you know, Fisher encourages us to use our imagination. Whatever can encourage us to be, because I guess I feel like Shikantaza, our form of Zazen in particular, because we don't have a technique to apply ourselves to, but it probably applies to all forms of meditation. It's a choice, not a, I mean, we tend to imagine ourselves as being divided, right? There's a part of ourselves that has decided we want to meditate, and then there's all these unruly parts of ourselves, our mind and our body, and, you know, that aren't obeying the one who's in charge and plan for us to meditate. And that one who's planning for us to meditate just needs to get stronger, crack the whip. I guess some people seem to have success with that approach, but I have very unruly, you know, my unruly parts are just get unrulier when I do that. So if I look at it as a choice, then it's like there are things we can do to encourage ourselves to make that choice, to encourage ourselves to let go, to open up, to, you know, whatever meditation we're applying ourselves to, you know, reminding ourselves of impermanence, not self, you know, let it, like what I shared on Sunday, this sense of opening up to intimacy, listening, being aware that the, you know, the whole universe is around me, and if I don't shut up, I'm not going to notice. So, yeah. And I think that sometimes these motivations, they, you know, might have to change over time. They do for me anyway. I'll come up with something, I'll be like, yes, now I got it. And then, I don't know, a couple weeks later, you know, my mind is like, who cares? Maybe, like, for a while that was really helping, like, this is the last day of your life. And then after a while it just stopped. I just was like, this is the last day of your life. I just couldn't connect with it anymore. Such a bummer. So just in closing, I guess I really appreciated Fisher's description of Zazen and how the way that we approach meditation, the way that we approach whatever, practice, enlightenment, if you will, is the sense that we already have everything we need. And I really loved his section on how the body is already awakened. Neat way to put it. So on page 160, maybe we can understand Dogen's point this way. The body is already awakened. The body knows precisely how to live the truth of impermanence/permanence. It knows how to change moment by moment. It understands perfectly well how things arise and pass away simultaneously, and it is fully capable of dying and mixing with other elements to continue its cosmic journey forever. Just as the Buddha and Bodhidharma were already awakened before they practiced, so our bodies are already awakened, even if our minds and hearts are not. Our already awakened bodies lead us to our meditation cushion and guide us through the gentle passage to peace. for Dogen the Buddha and Bodhidharma were inspiring devotional figures in whom he had warm faith. Since they practiced sitting meditation because they were already awakened, we too should practice it because we too are already awakened. We should practice it with them, for them, and for all sacred living creatures who share the same nature of already being awakened Buddhas. For Dogen, formal meditation is not instrumental effort. It is devotional practice. So that's a whole discussion in and of itself. Any last comments or questions?
I just wanted to say thanks to people for sharing their just this private kind of meditation experience that you don't see. I just find it so fascinating to listen to what it's like for other people. So just wanted to say thanks.
Katie?
Oh, just that when I read this book the first time, you know, before you guys took it on, I hadn't been meditating. And I almost skipped that I just skimmed through it because I didn't have anything to attach it to. I didn't have any experience to attach it to. And so this time reading it, it's just like, oh, yes. Mm. It was a lot more powerful. So appreciated that.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. I really appreciate everybody sharing as well. I know that, you know, going off into breakout rooms and having to share is not everybody's, you know, foremost cup of tea, but it really is like, it really does build Sangha, especially in this time that, you know, we don't get the chance to just like stand in the foyer and chat or, you know, talk over a cup of tea or work side by side. So, you know, sharing these kinds of things and experiences is, I think, very valuable. And you never know, like, I had the great fortune of growing up, like dharmically growing up, in a sangha that had multiple teachers. So we had, you know, a married couple. So we had the two head teachers, and then they had senior students by the time I came around who were also moving into teaching roles. So there was usually like four or five different teaching voices, and they were all very different. And so I kind of got to take that for granted. So, you know, I'm kind of the only teaching voice here most of the time. And so the experiences of other people, sometimes it can help people put something together, or you hear something from somebody and like, it's much more useful than what the teacher happened to say that night, right? Because it, you know, you never know where you're going to get what you need from. So, all right, I will close with our verse. Dedicate the merit of our Sangha practice to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. I think everybody's evening for everybody. Have a good rest of your evening.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks, Tanya.
Thank you for being here.